All right, welcome to the deep dive. We're going to be taking a deep dive today into ALCO Finance Limited VCLI. This case is super interesting for anybody interested in renewable energy, and especially the legal side of things. We're going to look at some really fascinating concepts in energy law.
Yeah, this case really gets into the weeds of federal preemption, the Dormant Commerce Clause,
Oh yeah.
all related to how states are trying to promote renewable energy.
Exactly.
And I think this is going to be a good one for our listeners, especially if they are interested in energy law, or even if they're just trying to get a better grasp on some of these key concepts.
Yeah, and it's complex stuff, right?
It is.
So hopefully we can break it down, make it a little bit more digestible.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So just to kind of set the stage for everybody, the ALCO v. CLI case really boils down to a fundamental tension. You've got these state-level goals to increase renewable energy,
Right.
and then you've got federal energy law, and where exactly is the line between the two?
Right. And it's this line that we're really going to be looking at today.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So who are our main players here? Well, on one side, you've got ALCO Finance Limited. They're a solar developer based in New York.
Okay.
And on the other side, you have the folks who regulate energy in Connecticut.
All right. So we've got New York versus Connecticut in a way.
In a sense, yeah.
Okay.
So the background here is that Connecticut passed a couple of laws aimed at, as I said, boosting renewable energy. These were Public Acts 13303 and 15107.
Okay.
And their approach involved a few different things. They wanted to incentivize renewable energy development, so they started soliciting proposals for renewable energy projects. And then they required utilities in the state to sign power purchase agreements,
Okay.
or PPAs, as they're often called,
Got it.
with the companies whose projects were selected.
Okay.
So that's one piece of it. They also had this thing called a Renewable Portfolio Standard, or an RPS. And this mandated that utilities had to buy a certain percentage of their electricity from renewable sources. And specifically, they had to do this through these things called Regional Renewable Energy Credits, or RECs.
So Connecticut was really putting a framework in place to try to make renewable energy a bigger part of their energy mix.
Right, yeah, they were actively trying to incentivize it. So, as you mentioned, we've got ELCO, this New York-based solar developer, and they saw an opportunity here. They saw that Connecticut was trying to boost renewable energy,
Right.
and they said, hey, we can get in on this. So they submitted bids for a number of solar projects in Connecticut,
Makes sense, yeah.
hoping to secure those PPAs. And as we know, those PPAs are basically long-term contracts to sell electricity.
Exactly.
So they would have been a pretty big deal for ALCO.
Yeah, a steady source of revenue.
Right, exactly. Now, here's where things get interesting. ALCO, for whatever reason, was not selected for any of the projects.
Okay, so their bids were unsuccessful.
Yeah, they didn't get any of those power purchase
So,
agreements,
yeah.
and that's what led to this whole legal battle.
Okay, so this is what sparked the lawsuit.
Exactly, yeah. ALCO basically said, hey, wait a minute. We think Connecticut is stepping on federal toes here. And their main arguments were about federal preemption.
Right, this idea that federal law supersedes state law in certain areas.
Right, exactly. So they were claiming that Connecticut's program conflicted with a couple of key federal laws, the Federal Power Act, or FPA, and then also the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act of 1978, or PURPA.
Okay.
They also argued that Connecticut's policies were violating something called the Dormant Commerce Clause. And this basically prevents states from discriminating against businesses from other states.
Right.
So they were saying that Connecticut was unfairly favoring in-state or regional businesses over out-of-state companies like ALCO.
Got it. So ALCO had multiple lines of attack here in this lawsuit.
Yeah, they were trying to hit Connecticut from multiple angles, trying to show that their program was overstepping in a number of ways. And just to be clear, this wasn't just a one-time thing.
Right.
ALCO went to court more than once.
They didn't give up easily.
No, they didn't. They first sued Connecticut back in 2014. And that case, which is often referred to as ALCO-I,
Okay.
was dismissed by the district court.
And why was that?
Well, the judge basically said that ALCO didn't have standing, which we'll explain in more detail later.
Okay.
And he also said that they didn't state a valid legal claim.
Okay.
So, double whammy right there.
Right.
And then the Second Circuit Court of Appeals upheld that dismissal. They agreed with the district court. And that case is often referred to as ALCO-tism. But like I said, ALCO didn't give up. They came back in 2015 with some similar arguments challenging some new renewable energy solicitations that Connecticut had put out.
So they tried again with basically a similar lawsuit.
Yeah, round two.
Interesting.
But again, same outcome. The district court dismissed their claims.
Okay.
You know, citing similar issues with standing and also finding that their legal arguments just weren't persuasive.
Hmm.
And yet again, the Second Circuit affirmed the lower court's decision.
Okay. So ALCO went to bat twice and struck out both times.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
So let's dive deeper into these legal arguments that ALCO is making, starting with the federal preemption argument.
Okay, sounds good.
Can you explain a little bit more about, you know, what ALCO was claiming in terms of how Connecticut's program was interfering with federal law?
Sure. So, you know, as we mentioned, ALCO argued that by setting up this program with these power purchase agreements, mm-hmm. Connecticut was essentially setting wholesale electricity prices.
Okay.
They said that Connecticut was forcing utilities into these contracts, and that this whole process was stepping on the federal government's turf, specifically under the Federal Power Act, or the FPA. Mm-hmm. And the FPA, you know, it gives the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or ARRC,
mm-hmm.
exclusive jurisdiction over the sale of wholesale electricity in interstate commerce.
So ALCO was basically saying, Connecticut, you're meddling in the wholesale electricity market, and that's FERC's job, not yours.
Exactly, yeah. They also brought in PERPO, claiming that Connecticut wasn't fulfilling PERPA's requirement to purchase power from these qualifying facilities,
mm-hmm.
Which are often called QF.
Okay, so two separate federal laws that ALCO felt Connecticut was violating.
Right. Now, the court, however, didn't buy ALCO's arguments about federal preemption.
Okay.
They made a couple of key points. First, they emphasized that the bidding process in Connecticut was voluntary. Utilities weren't obligated to enter into these power purchase agreements.
Okay.
They chose to submit bids, and then they had the option of whether or not to actually sign a contract with the developer.
So it wasn't like Connecticut was twisting their arms and saying, you have to buy this power.
Right, exactly. It was more like, hey, here's an opportunity. If you're interested, submit a bid.
Okay.
And then the court also made a point of saying that, look, even if these agreements are reached, they're still subject to review by FRC.
Right, that federal oversight was still there.
Exactly.
So that seems like a pretty big deal. The federal government, through FRC, still had the final say to make sure that these agreements were fair and reasonable.
Right, and that was really key for the court. They said that because of this FRC review process, Connecticut wasn't actually usurping federal authority.
Okay, I'm starting to see how the court came to its conclusion here.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And it's also worth noting that the court distinguished Connecticut's program from another case that we've talked about on the show before, the Hughes v. Talen Energy Marketing case.
Right, right.
Where a state program was found to be preempted by federal law.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hughes, the state program was directly tied to these FERC-regulated options.
Okay.
So in that case, the state was basically setting prices based on a federal mechanism.
Right, so a much more direct interference with FERC's role.
Exactly. And the court said that Connecticut's program didn't have that same issue. It wasn't directly interfering with FRC's processes in the same way.
Got it. So it seems like the court is drawing a pretty clear line here. States can try to nudge the market towards renewables,
mm-hmm.
but they can't step directly into the federal government's role of setting wholesale electricity prices.
Right. That's a good way to put it.
Okay, that clears up the FPA side of things.
Mm-hmm.
What about the PRQA argument? Can you unpack that one a little bit more? ALCO is saying Connecticut should have been required to buy power from their solar facilities under PRPA.
Yeah, so remember, PRPA has this rule that requires utilities to buy power from certain facilities that are called qualifying facilities,
mm-hmm.
or QFs. And these QFs have to meet certain criteria.
Okay.
But one important thing to remember about those QFs is that there's a size limitation.
Okay.
Under PRPA, a QF can't have a generating capacity of more than 80 megawatts.
Okay, so it's specifically for smaller renewable energy projects.
Right, exactly. And in ALCO's case, the solar projects that they were proposing were significantly larger than 80 megawatts.
Okay.
So the court said, look, ALCO's projects don't qualify for this mandatory purchase obligation under PRA.
Right, they weren't small enough to fall under that specific provision.
Right.
Got it. That makes sense. So the federal preemption arguments, both under FPA and PRA, didn't really hold up in court.
Yeah, the court wasn't persuaded.
Okay. Now let's move on to the Dormant Commerce Clause. You know, as we've discussed, Alcoa was saying that Connecticut's renewable portfolio standard was unfairly discriminating against energy producers in other states.
Right. Yeah, specifically because the RPS favored renewable energy credits, or RECs, that were generated within the region.
Mm-hmm.
And Alco, you know, being based in New York, they weren't able to take advantage of that regional preference.
Right, right. They were effectively shut out of the market.
Yeah, and so they argued that this regional preference was a form of protectionism that violated the Dormant Commerce Clause. They say Connecticut was essentially putting up a barrier to out-of-state renewable energy
mm-hmm.
by making it more difficult, you know, or less advantageous
yeah.
for companies outside the region to participate in their renewable energy market.
Yeah, it almost sounds like they were trying to create a little renewable energy bubble within their own region.
Right. But the court, again, didn't side with Alco on this one either.
Okay. So how did the court justify its decision in this case? What was their reasoning?
So the court ultimately held that Connecticut's RPS program did not violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. And their reasoning had to do with this idea of RECs being state-created commodities.
Okay.
And they relied on a really important precedent here, the General Motors v. Tracy case, which is a Supreme Court case that dealt with this issue of whether in-state and out-of-state products have to be treated the same under the Commerce Clause.
Mm-hmm.
And in General Motors v. Tracy, the court said that, look, sometimes products that might seem similar on the surface can actually be different for the purposes of the Dormant Commerce Clause if they serve different purposes or have different attributes.
Interesting. So is that what the court was getting at here, that RECs from inside the region and RECs from outside the region are not really like products in the same way that, say, apples from one state and apples from another state would be?
Exactly. Yeah, that's precisely what they were saying. They said that, look, regional RECs serve specific state interests.
Okay.
For example, they might help ensure the reliability of the local power grid,
mm-hmm.
or they might foster local environmental benefits.
Got it.
And the court concluded that any burden that this regional preference placed on interstate commerce
mm-hmm.
was incidental and justified by these local benefits.
Okay, so they're saying that even though there might be some impact on interstate commerce, it's outweighed by these local benefits.
Right. And that, you know, the state has a legitimate interest in promoting those local benefits.
So the court was basically saying, look, it's not just about the electricity being the same. It's about the specific attributes and the policy goals tied to where that renewable energy is generated.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really interesting. It adds a whole other layer to the analysis. It's not just about the product itself. It's about the context and the purpose.
Right, right.
All right. So we've talked about the major legal arguments that Alco made,
mm.
the federal preemption arguments, the Dormant Commerce Clause argument,
mm.
and the court's decisions on those.
Right.
Now, let's talk about something that sometimes can be a bit of a hurdle in legal cases, standing.
Okay, yeah, this is an important one.
We mentioned earlier that, you know, in that first lawsuit, Alco, the district court dismissed Alco's claims because they said that they lacked standing. Can you explain what standing is and why it's so important?
Sure. So standing is a really fundamental principle in our legal system, especially in federal court. It's basically the idea that to bring a lawsuit in federal court, a party has to show that they've actually been injured.
Okay.
Or harmed in some concrete way.
Got it.
And that injury is directly traceable to the conduct that they are challenging in court.
Okay, so it's not enough to just say, I don't like this law.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You have to show that the law has actually harmed you personally in some way.
Okay.
And that a favorable ruling from the court would actually remedy that harm.
So it has to be a real and direct injury.
Right, yeah, you have to have what's called a stake in the outcome.
Okay, so how did the court analyze Alco's standing in this particular case?
So the court actually analyzed Alco's standing separately for each of their claims.
Okay.
And interestingly, they came to different conclusions depending on which claim they were looking at.
All right. So let's break that down then. What about the preemption claim?
So for the federal preemption claim, the court found that Alco did not have standing.
Okay.
And their reasoning was that even if Connecticut's program was found to be preempted.
Right. There was no guarantee that Alco would have been selected for those power purchase agreements.
Okay.
There were other companies bidding.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Connecticut might have had other reasons for choosing those other bidders.
Right. So it was possible that Alco's bids just weren't competitive enough.
Exactly. Yeah. And because of that, the court said that Alco lacked something called redressability.
Okay. I've heard that term before.
Yeah.
What does it mean exactly in this context?
So redressability basically means that the court has to be able to provide a remedy that will actually fix the injury that the plaintiff has suffered.
Okay.
And in ALCO's case, the court said, look, even if we strike down Connecticut's program, we can't guarantee that ALCO would have gotten those contracts.
Right.
So we can't really redress their injury.
So even if Connecticut was potentially overstepping its bounds, ALCO wasn't necessarily in a position to challenge that in court because it wasn't clear that they were directly harmed.
Right. Yeah, at least not in a way that the court could fix. Okay, so that's the preemption claim. What about standing on the Dormant Commerce Clause claim?
So on the Dormant Commerce Clause claim, the court actually found that ALCO did have standing.
Interesting. Okay. Why was that?
Their reasoning was that because Connecticut's program favored regional RECs, it was essentially excluding ALCO's out-of-state RECs from the market.
Okay.
And that, the court said, was a concrete and particularized injury.
Right.
It was a direct economic harm that could potentially be fixed if the court struck down that regional preference.
So in that case, ALCO had a clear stake in the outcome, and a favorable ruling from the court could have actually made a difference for them.
Right, exactly. However, you know, it's important to remember that even though ALCO had standing to bring the Commerce Clause claim, they ultimately lost on the merits of that claim.
Right. The court decided that Connecticut's program didn't actually violate the Dormant Commerce Clause.
Right.
So standing is just the first hurdle. You have to clear that hurdle before the court will even consider the substance of your arguments.
Right. It's like a gatekeeper to the courthouse.
Okay. So we've covered a lot of ground here. Let's try to summarize some key takeaways. What are some of the main legal tests that this case reinforces?
All right. So in terms of federal preemption, this case really reinforces the test that we see coming out of that Hughes case.
Mm-hmm.
And that test is basically, does the state action effectively set wholesale electricity rates?
Okay.
Or does it interfere with FRC's authority over wholesale energy markets?
Got it. And in Connecticut's case, the court said no to both of those questions.
Exactly. The state wasn't dictating wholesale rates.
Right.
And they weren't bypassing FRC's oversight.
Okay. And what about on the Dormant Commerce Clause front?
So the Dormant Commerce Clause, the key takeaway is that, you know, the court is going to look very closely at whether the products that are being treated differently are truly like products, you know, for the purpose of the Dormant Commerce Clause.
Right.
And as we saw in the ALCO case, the court said that in this particular context, in-region and out-of-region RECs are not like products.
Because of the specific policy objectives and the attributes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's something that states need to be very mindful of when they're designing programs.
Okay. So what are some of the broader implications of this case for states that are looking to support renewable energy initiatives?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is that states do have quite a bit of flexibility to encourage renewable energy development.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they're careful not to cross these lines.
Right. They have to respect federal authority and the Commerce Clause.
Exactly. So if they're smart about it, they can design programs that will achieve their renewable energy goals without running afoul of federal law.
Okay. So this case provides some helpful guidance for states.
Yeah. It's a good roadmap.
And for our listeners out there who are law students or maybe just interested in energy law, what's one key lesson they can take away from this case?
Well, I think one really important lesson is about the scope of PRP, and specifically that mandatory purchase obligation.
Right, for those qualifying facilities.
Right, exactly. You know, this case highlights the fact that that obligation only applies to smaller renewable energy projects, and that beyond that, states actually have a lot of leeway to design their own incentives.
So it's not a one-size-fits-all federal mandate.
No, not at all.
Got it. Well, this has been a really interesting deep dive into a pretty complex case. It really shows how the law is grappling with these evolving energy issues and the tension between state and federal power.
Yeah. And it's definitely a case that's worth paying attention.
Especially for anyone interested in the future of renewable energy. So I think as we wrap up here, it's worth leaving our listeners with a final thought.
Okay.
You know, given all the advancements that we're seeing in renewable energy technologies and the evolving policies at both the state and federal levels, how do you think these legal boundaries might be tested or redefined in the years to come?
That's a great question. I think as renewable energy becomes more and more prevalent, we're bound to see more legal challenges. You know, we're going to have to figure out how to balance state and federal interests.
Right.
And how to ensure that the market is fair and competitive.
It's going to be an exciting area of the law to watch.
Yeah, definitely. Lots of interesting questions to grapple with.
Well, thanks for taking this deep dive with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
And thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.